and crafts for sale, personally handmade by the artists. Hotworks.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It isn't unusual for young women in their teens to suffer from anorexia. It's a disorder that causes these young people to think that they're fat even as they are starving themselves. What is unusual is for families to become involved in helping those who suffer from anorexia to recognize the problem and help them to recover from it. Conventional medical wisdom says the child should be separated from the family. Harriet Brown disagrees, and she comes at this from personal experience. Her daughter, Kitty, nearly died because of her struggle with anorexia, but Harriet refused not to be involved in her treatment and recovery. She tells her story and that of her daughter and their family in her book, Brave Girl Eating, A Family-Based Approach to Eating Disorders, and she shares that story with us this hour. Welcome to Charlotte, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Harriet Brown is also an associate professor of magazine journalism at the Newhouse School in Syracuse, New York. Boy, that's a field that's slimming in its ranks because magazines are slimming in their ranks, right?
We prefer to say they're evolving.
Well, they are.
And they are indeed.
Because I now get two magazines on my iPad only. They
don't
even print them anymore. And I like it almost better.
There you go.
Also with us is Dr. Preeti Matkins, MD, the medical director at Teen Health Connection, a nonprofit healthcare practice. She works with teens struggling with eating disorders. She's also director of adolescent medicine at Levine Children's Medicine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you. And because anorexia nervosa is a disorder of the body and the mind, we've invited Libby Seifert to be with us. She's a psychologist and executive director of Teen Health Connection. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Good morning.
Good morning. I should also point out that Harriet Brown is speaking at the 5th anniversary of the Center for Disordered Eating. I hesitate to call it a celebration, but I guess it is a celebration. It's a free community conversation on Wednesday the 8th at 6 p.m. at the Levine Jewish Community Center. Your book, Harriet, takes us through your daughter's illness from the earliest warning signs through treatment and into recovery. So aside from your family's participation in Kitty's recovery, which we will talk about, how does Kitty's story differ from the thousands of people who have to go through this because their child is suffering from it?
Well, I don't think it differs at all. I mean, I think that anorexia is an illness that often presents in this culture with very similar symptoms and very similar signs and has a sort of predictable trajectory. And so I think what happened to my daughter was actually very common for other kids with anorexia nervosa.
And I use the example, and your book is obviously about your daughter, and so people automatically associate this many times with girls, but boys get this too. Boys have a problem with this too. How many males are affected by anorexia?
Well, I can tell you that at Teen Health Connection at our Center for Disordered Eating, about 18% of the teens that we care for are males.
That's high. Now, is that because men, young men, and older men are being as affected by the images they see in the media, in magazines, in like Men's Health magazine, where everybody is rippled and buff, and they expect to be that way too, and that's an unrealistic expectation, just as unrealistic as some of the teen model magazines for girls?
Well, we don't know. First of all, you know, at Center for Disordered Eating, our patients are either our Teen Health Connection patients or are referred to us from their primary care providers, from their schools, from parents who hear about us. So in some sense, we are a referral center, so we may have more patients. Another issue is whether the incidence is increasing or we're just recognizing that. Mm-hmm. And certainly, overall, the research says 5 to 10% of all patients with eating disorders are males, but that's identified eating disorders. So we don't know. It may be because we're a referral center. It may be because the incidence is rising. And why it's rising is something I think is very complicated because media images, people, including family members, parents, coaches, everybody talks about their body and how they want to look and swimsuit season coming. And some people are affected by that and some are not. So I think our society and focusing on how somebody looks and numbers as opposed to being healthy certainly is a contributing factor. but it's very multifactorial.
That's something you write about. Because you talk about obese children as well, and how parents sometimes scold, and it's viewed by the child as bullying them because of their eating habits. And you, have, I think, Harriet, have said that as long as we focus on, well, I'm going to paraphrase this, I can't remember the quote, but it's about health versus, I can't find it in my notes here, but it's about, tell me what you said, because I can't find it.
Well, I think that our cultural as well as our personal obsession with focusing on weight and the numbers on the scale and looking like models, you know, et cetera, that is not helpful. And if we could separate that and talk instead about health, because we know that, you know, health and weight are different things. You can be thin and healthy, thin and unhealthy. You know, you can be overweight, obese, and healthy or unhealthy. So it's really more about behaviors than physical body.
I found it. You wrote an article in the New York Times, and you said that parents of children who may be overweight and who are only trying to help by pressing their kids to lose weight may be doing more harm than good. Would the same be true of parents who are facing the situation that you faced with your daughter and begging her to eat or forcing her to eat? And were you doing more harm than good? How do you know where the line is? Because you have the best interest of the child at heart, obviously.
Yeah, and I'll tell you exactly where the line is. The line is that anorexia nervosa is an illness and obesity is not. And so anorexia being an illness, and an illness that can kill a child in the short term rather than the long term, it is necessary for someone. It doesn't have to be parents. But in my experience, and maybe the medical people will have a different perspective, in my experience, nobody recovers from anorexia alone without help, especially not teens.
There was a reaction here from Dr. Matkins when you said that anorexia is a disease and obesity is not. Or
she said illness, which to me is a little bit different than disease. But I would say this. The difference is a focus on health, whether it is with the eating disorder, anorexia, bulimia, or eating disorder not otherwise specified, or overweight or obesity or prediabetes, all those things. When we make the focus a number, mm-hmm. and whether it's we being healthcare providers, therapists, dietitians, parents, family members, school system, about a number instead of health, that's the error we make. Children who are obese may also have mental health needs, and it's not simple. And part of it is our society does tend to think, oh, you need to lose this much weight by this time, and then everything's okay. So I would say, in some sense, anybody who is caring for someone who has an eating disorder, the issue is about health, and that's where numbers may be important. But in our program, we don't say somebody has to get to 90th percentile of ideal body weight, and that's where you're cured, because certainly eating disorders are a disease, and it's a multifactorial disease with mental health, medical components, with nutritional support. So we say we don't want you to focus on a number. It's not about this or getting your period back, which is very important. It's about having a healthy relationship with food, and that would go with anybody with an eating disorder, that you can say, oh, I missed a meal, and it's important to me. I've been studying for 8 hours in this library, and I'm important enough that I need that for my brain mm-hmm. and for nutrition. And it's also okay to wake up the next morning and say, I had too much last night, but this is a new day, and I'm worth it, and we move forward. So our goal is a healthy relationship with food and being healthy, not a number.
You may have already partially answered this question in your last comment, but I was going to ask, there are three words floating around the room today: illness, disease, disorder.
Yes.
So what exactly is anorexia? Is it an illness? Is it a disease? Is it a disorder? What's the difference between
It's a disease.
Okay.
It is.
Why?
Because it is not a choice. It is something that is not identifiable by certain socioeconomic or ethnicities or where you live. It is multifactorial in genetics, in maybe somebody's more prone to it than someone else, and there's a lot of research there about that. And I'm going to say part of the reason I call it a disease is when you call it something else, it almost makes it a choice, which many people think people with eating disorders choose to have an eating disorder. It is a disease, and that means that the person with the disease isn't to blame for it, and certainly the parents are not to blame for it.
Libby, you're the psychologist here, so is it more of a disease of the, because it certainly affects the body with dire consequences, is it more of a disease of the mind or a disease of the body?
I think it's an interaction. And I think for me, the important thing is that the Center for Disordered Eating, okay, mm-hmm. it's not the Center for Eating Disorders. So from the psychological perspective, you have to meet certain criteria in order to have a diagnosed disorder, right? Dieting mm-hmm. can be disordered eating. It's that obsession. And I love what, you know, Harriet speaks about, the obsession around weight and the number and the body. One of the things that we do that's different at Teen Health Connection, when we weigh one of our patients, male or female, they're weighed in the exam room in a gown in private. And oftentimes their weight is not told to the teen or to the parent.
Let me interrupt. In general, we do not share that weight. Not oftentimes, almost always, until they're far enough along in therapy. Sorry, Libby.
Because such a focus is on that number, and we want to take the focus off of the number. And it really is about having a healthy relationship with food. I mean, that's one of the relationships that we're all going to have for our entire lives.
Should we all throw away our scales?
Well, I think it's also a clinical indicator, and when appropriate, you know, it should be used. But if you're weighing every day, uh-huh. 2-3 times a day, well, it's probably not a good use of the scale.
Okay. Let me make a comment about that. There is somebody who's on a national television show, a morning show that has a book out right now, and she said that her mood every day depends on that number on the scale, and her happiness has to do with if she's a pound above, it's a bad day. And when I read that...
So is that something that would trigger anorexia, or is anorexia something that is
I don't know, because I haven't treated her. I know that okay. She says in her book that she has seen a therapist, and I don't know how forthcoming she is with personal information. But to me, if your happiness is based on a number, that's outside the range of normal.
Well, Kitty was 14 when mm-hmm. you first noticed this. She
yes.
was 4 feet 11, 71.
I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
I really feel very strongly about not putting numbers out there, and there are no numbers in the book.
Where did I get these numbers?
From the New York Times Magazine piece that came
okay.
out.
Well,
and the reason is because it's very triggering to people who may be struggling with these issues to hear these numbers.
Okay.
And I don't think it's that relevant, really.
And
really?
Yes.
And as you ask her the question, I'm going to tell you, as I tell many of my patients, they could be medically unstable and have a weight and a height that someone else with that same weight, height, age, and gender may not have an eating
right.
disorder.
Exactly.
It's about the other symptoms. So
right.
sorry, Harriet.
Okay.
No, exactly, exactly.
But she was thin.
She was way too thin. There's no question.
And she would look in the mirror, and when you would tell her to eat, she would call herself, and this is a quote from that article, a fat pig.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible?
That is a very good question that actually we don't fully know the answer. There's been some fascinating research done by Walt Kay out at UC San Diego. What we know now is genetics play a role in neurobiology, and the way you see yourself in your brain, the way you literally process images of yourself, may be very different from how you process other people's images.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about Kitty and also about anorexia in general with Harriet Brown, Dr. Preeti Matkins, and Libby Seyfried. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Athena Health, provider of cloud-based EHR practice management and care coordination services, helping health systems drive clinical and financial performance under any payment scenario. AthenaHealth.com/NCNPR. Well, after months of negotiations by a bipartisan group of senators dubbed the Gang of Eight, the new 800-page immigration package has been unveiled. The push for comprehensive immigration reform has been called a good first step by some, with others voicing concern about certain parts of the bill. So guest host Michael Tomczyk will examine the bill along with his guests to find out what it covers, who would be affected, and talk with a Charlotte immigrant to find out how this would change his immigration status. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a New York court rules local governments can ban the practice of hydraulic fracturing, the fight over fracking at the grassroots level around the country.
Join us for that discussion on the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 until noon, right after Charlotte Talks. You're on listener-supported public radio. We are 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Harriet Brown is the author of Brave Girl Eating, A Family-Based Approach to Eating Disorders. Her daughter Kitty had, and I guess still has, anorexia. Do you recover from it completely or do you always have it?
No, you absolutely can recover from it completely.
Okay.
She has not yet, but I believe she will.
Okay.
Because she did have a relapse when she was a little bit older. But people recover all the time, fully, go on and live lives, never bother them again. Some people it may recur later, but that notion that you once you have it, you always have it, that it's like alcoholism in that way, I don't think is borne out by the research or by anecdote.
Dr. Preeti Matkins is also with us. She's medical director of the Teen Health Connection and director of adolescent medicine at Levine Children's Medicine. And Libby Seyfried is a psychologist and executive director of Teen Health Connection. Let's talk about Kitty. That's what this book is about. It's your daughter. When did she first exhibit signs of anorexia to you?
When the spring she was 14, and we didn't recognize them as signs of anorexia. I think at that time, like most people who've never had any personal experience with it, I had certain ideas. Well, to have anorexia, you had to lose a lot of weight. She hadn't lost a lot of weight. What she did exhibit was a lot of anxiety.
And about food or just anxiety in general?
No, in general. And it didn't seem food-based, although in retrospect, I think I wasn't probably paying close enough attention because 14 is the age where kids are, you know, becoming more autonomous. And as a parent, it's the age where you're stepping back just a little bit. You're letting them make a few more decisions. And so, you know, she was making more decisions and I wasn't paying strict attention. But she became anxious. She became very emotional. And then, in retrospect, the tip-off, which I didn't realize at the time, was she started being very interested in cooking, a kid who had never been interested in cooking. She wanted a subscription to Gourmet magazine, a kid I couldn't even get to make, you know, chocolate chip cookies with me when she was 10. She started planning a birthday lunch for me 6 months in advance. And then she became, then the anxiety did start to take on a food element. She would call me at work on Monday, needing to know what we were having for dinner on Friday. And if I said, I have no idea, she would become so anxious that I literally had to tell her something, or she would just, you know, freak out for hours.
Wow.
And that's when we realized, yeah, we really do have a problem here.
Is this behavior what you see repeated? This is not uncommon behavior for people who are suffering from
this. No, it's not. It's, I mean, some parts of it, yes. I mean, the obsession with the food and the eating, that's not uncommon.
Because I've read that a lot of times these people will suddenly be interested in cooking, and cooking, mm-hmm. actually cooking for everybody, but not eating anything.
That's right.
How do you explain
sometimes
that?
It's not really about wanting to become a chef. It's about controlling what food, what they're counting, and what they're eating. So it becomes, for example, going out to eat becomes very difficult. If you order something and you have broccoli on the side, is that broccoli steamed or is it sauteed? Is it in oil? Is it in butter? How much is it? How much salt is in there? Is that going to make me retain water? All this stuff that you don't know when you order out at a restaurant, but if you control the food at home, mm-hmm. then you know what's in there. So that's one of our first steps in family-based treatment.
And the prescription for Gourmet magazine, was that to learn to cook better, or was it simply to know what to know about what's in the food?
Well, I think Dr. Matkins is right, but I also think there might be another element too, and uh-huh. just strictly speaking as a parent, I think that when you are starving, that hunger, that need for food, even if you can't eat it, comes out in other ways. And so it comes out in this obsession with...
It seems like self-torture. If you're not eating and you're starving and you're and you're feeling the physical effects of that, to look at a picture of food would be torture.
That is the illness. It is a confounding, counterintuitive, very difficult to understand illness, but that is...
That's absolutely right. And the reason that you don't get it, and I don't, because we don't have eating disorders, but that's right. Just holding the food, even cooking it and presenting it to someone else is some satisfaction.
It's like a self-affirming. You know, like, I didn't eat that, that sort of victory over, like, being at the party and cutting the cake for everybody else but not having any yourself. See how strong I am?
But it's also a, in some sense,
like vicarious.
Almost a feeling, yes, vicariously partaking,
yes.
Without actually partaking.
Now, this is different, obviously, from bulimia, because if you have bulimia, you eat, but then you purge. But is there a difference in the psychology of it, or what causes it? Or are you equally, if you're somebody who is prone to be... to have an eating disorder,
well,
could it go one way or the other?
Yes, I think. Though there's not a whole lot of research on that. So people with bulimia may be more likely to have other comorbid conditions like anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive traits or disorder.
But aren't these the same signs that anorexics have, anxiety, depression?
The signs, but whether they actually have the disease. So that's really hard when somebody is so malnourished. And remember, in adolescence, depression may not show up as sadness, but as irritability. Mm-hmm. So if you're starved, you're going to be irritable, may have less interest in things that used to interest you. It's a little hard early on to say whether somebody has an eating disorder and depression or anxiety, or they have depression or anxiety symptoms because of the eating disorder. So that's where our multidisciplinary approach is so important, because you have to get somebody a little more healthy before you can assess those symptoms and what needs to be done as far as medication. So it's hard to tell whether one causes the other or they both are present at the same time.
So prior to age 14 and prior to the first signs that you recognized as being a problem, even if you couldn't name what the problem was, was Kitty a normal eater? Did she eat what everybody else ate? Did she like ice cream? Oh, yeah.
In fact, she was a very adventurous eater. In fact, we had this favorite Italian restaurant we went to, and when she was four, She was the kid who went and ate an entire bowl of mussels in butter. And the chef was so astounded by this, he came out to see this four-year-old who had enjoyed these mussels and gave her a free plate of ice cream, which she happily ate. She loved food and she loved eating, and she had a perfectly normal relationship with it.
And she was, you wouldn't look at her and say that she was overweight or underweight. She was right for her.
She was athletic, so she always was pretty fit. She was a gymnast, and
so does this mostly happen? Does this mostly present itself in your teenage years, or can this happen at any stage of your life?
At any stage, so
really? So it's not necessarily related to hormones or something that goes on in puberty.
But it most often does.
We don't know. It does most often present itself in young adulthood, adolescence. But it certainly can be later, and it can be younger. So we have had some very young patients. Though our age range is generally 11 to 22 at Teen Health Connection. I've had a couple of 8 or 9-year-olds.
Because it's also in middle school, I believe. Been a long time since I've been there, that you start learning a little bit about nutrition and food and how it affects your body, what's good for you, what's not good for you. And
I think that comes earlier now.
Does it come earlier? So does that kind of knowledge trigger in something like this in those who are predisposed to have it?
I believe it does. And again, anecdotally, that was part of, I think, what triggered Kitty, not caused. But in sixth grade, she had a wellness class, and I remember she came home and said, you know, sugar is bad for you, dessert is bad, I'm not eating dessert anymore. And, you know, the thing is, probably every kid in the class came home and said something like that, but 2 weeks later, she was the only one who was still not eating sugar. So because she had this underlying predisposition, her brain was wired a certain way, there's definitely a genetic component. She glommed onto this and took it to the max.
Anybody in your family that you know of in the past who was an anorexic?
Not anorexia, but definitely bulimia. My I have an aunt who was bulimic, and I think there's some probably binge eating disorder in the family too. So it's not necessarily specific anorexia. The two biggest risk factors for, speaking genetically are history of any eating disorder and history of anxiety disorders, which we definitely have in our family.
Do we know that this is has a genetic component, or do we simply believe that it might have a genetic component?
Well, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could do a test and then we could do prevention and treatment. No, there is not a gene identified specifically or a test for that. But what we do know is that sort of family history in some people. But just as some diseases can be a new mutation that happens when no one else has it in the family, it certainly is an area of research. It would be nice if we could just do a blood test on everybody at a certain age. But Harriet is right, because there is some component of genetics, puberty, environment, and why does somebody hear a message and develop an eating disorder, and someone else live in a house where every calorie is counted and every discussion is how much somebody worked out, and they don't. So, and I do have patients who say, hey, when I was in X grade, and I'm not picking on anybody, my coach, my ballet, my dance teacher, somebody said, hey, you're getting a little curvy, or you're going to have to watch it. Or my football coach said, hey, you're not going to make whatever level of football if you weigh more than 110 pounds. So this is how you need to get below that by next Saturday. You know, and some people develop an eating disorder and some do not. Hmm. So we don't know what causes
it. Your book is called Brave Girl Eating. Why the word brave?
For a very specific reason. People with eating disorders, especially anorexia, are often blamed for them. They're often thought to be vain, that it's, you just want to look good in a swimsuit, or you're acting out in some way, you're rebelling, or, that it's basically that there's a level of choice and responsibility and blame. And I think what people don't understand is that when someone has anorexia and they eat, it is an act of extreme courage, because what's basically the experience of anorexia is terror, literal terror when faced with food. It would be like, if I had to jump out of an airplane, which to me would be like the worst thing in the world. And so, what we observed in our daughter was every bite she ate was an act of courage. She had to go against the voice in her head telling her, you're horrible, you're disgusting, if you eat this, you can't eat this. She had to go against the guilt and the fear and everything that was overwhelming her. And she had to do it over and over and over and over again. And I think that I wanted people to know that people with anorexia are very, very brave. Whether they recover or not, whatever happens, they are facing down a demon that most of us would behave exactly the same way if we felt that way.
But it goes against being logical. That's what people have a tough time understanding. Surely when you look in the mirror, and Karen Carpenter is probably the most famous person who had this and who died from it.
But you don't see yourself the way you are in the mirror. And we don't know why that is, but we do know that that's true. There's proprioception, the way your brain experiences your body in space, the way you literally see yourself. It's what they call dysregulated in people with anorexia. They literally cannot see themselves that way.
Lest people think that this is just some little nuisance that people either grow out of or don't. This is a serious disease. 15%, I'm told, of the people who suffer from it die from suicide or from complications related to starvation. What about those who turn themselves around? And we'll talk about treatment, but in general, how do they do it, and how do they keep themselves in a mindset that they're more healthy, that eating is not the brave thing that it is for somebody in full blown anorexia?
So first, I would say you have to talk a little bit about treatment, but when somebody is recovered, which they can be, like I said, the goal is a healthy relationship with food. And so that means that recognizing those triggers that they may be making, they may be going down a path that's unhealthy for them, and knowing who their support system is, which is their family, their therapist, mm-hmm. knowing when they need to go back, knowing those transition times that may be difficult for them. So college is a big deal. And having a child is a big deal because everybody wants to know how some movie star lost weight in six weeks after having a baby. You know, it is – so knowing where those things are very important.
Put your headphones on. I want to take a call from Jessica in Charlotte who has identified herself as a recovered anorexic. Jessica, welcome to WFAE.
Hi, thank you so much. Yeah, I was anorexic for more than 10 years, and it was only a 12-week hospitalization that saved my life. And I think it's so wonderful that your guest was able to help her daughter in this family-based way. But I worry that parents listening in might think, oh, I can do this at home by myself. And sometimes you just can't, and sometimes the child needs to go into the hospital where eating is not a choice. I mean, I wasn't force-fed, but I was in a program where it was a reward system. So if I ate 100% of my meal, I got to go outside for an hour, that sort of thing. And when my body was starving and I couldn't think straight, that was what I needed. Once my body was at a more normal weight, I was able to leave and engage in some of these, you know, family therapies, etc., and I was on my way to recovery. But sometimes medical in-hospital intervention really is the only way to save your child's life.
Well, I want to talk in the next segment about treatment, and specifically about this family approach, this Maudsley approach, which comes from England that you discovered and chose to do for your daughter. But you did not do it all by yourself, correct?
No, and you shouldn't do it by yourself. This isn't like DIY plumbing where parents are just at home following a chart. So I agree with you that you absolutely need support. The idea behind family-based treatment is that families basically do what was done for you in the hospital. A little, you know, details a little different, but families basically take charge of what the child or teen needs to eat and make sure that they do. but families need support to do that. So, yes, there's a whole treatment protocol, which Dr. Matkins can speak to as well.
So, Jessica, you're absolutely right. That is part of our treatment program, having multidisciplinary, and that's my medical role as well as the mental health piece when somebody is unstable, whether it is from electrolyte abnormalities, heart problems, low heart rate, low blood pressure, reasons that they have to be hospitalized. And we do have a protocol at Levine Children's Hospital regarding that. And then the next level, and that's for medical stabilization, the next level is inpatient eating disorder residential treatment, which you are right that what the patient needs guides us with the decisions that are made, with their family, of course.
I just want to add very quickly that I'm 42 and I have two beautiful, healthy children and I'm happily married and I have a career, so it is possible to get better.
Yay, that's so wonderful.
Congratulations. Thank you for your call, Jessica. I appreciate it. We only have a few seconds left before the break, but I would think that when you confront someone for the first time who is suffering from this, denial is putting it mildly. Is that what you get back?
Oh, my goodness.
Let me have 30 seconds.
Go ahead, Dr. Matthews.
It depends. So some of our patients actually have told their family that they need help.
Oh.
Some of them, I'm very proud, their peers have told their parents, we're worried about so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some who come to see us whose parents have told them absolutely nothing. So it runs the gamut.
Okay.
And we address it as we need to.
Maybe we can explore that a little more with more time on the other side of the break. We'll take one and come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting Avenue Q, an award-winning musical about Princeton, a recent graduate who moves to New York to discover his purpose in life. May 17th through June 2nd, tickets at CarolinaTix.org. A New York court rules local governments can ban the practice of hydraulic fracturing. Diane Rehm and her guests discuss the ongoing debate over the regulation of fracking in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
What What's the question you'd most like to ask of the most powerful politician, or the most innovative scientist, or the most talented musician? This is Robert Siegel from All Things Considered, where we specialize in asking that kind of question every day. Your curiosity is our curiosity. A place to get answers every weekday afternoon, All Things Considered, from NPR News.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about anorexia and about one particular person's decision to seek family treatment instead of hospitalization for their daughter, Kitty. That's Harriet Brown, the author of Brave Girl Eating, A Family's Struggle with Anorexia, because it really does become the family's struggle. Dr. Preeti Matkins is with us, medical director of the Teen Health Connection and director of adolescent medicine at Levine Children's Medicine, and Libby Seifert, a psychologist and the executive director of Teen Health Connection. I asked a question with very little time before the break about reactions from people who suffer from this when they are confronted by parents, friends, elders saying, you have a problem and we need to get you help. And the reaction is denial, and it can be sometimes irrational. And is the word violent? Or it can certainly be what?
I don't know if in some sense it's irrational to those of us that have normal thought process regarding food and body image. So to them, they do see it. And Harriet, you comment about that. The research does show there's a brain-level hypothalamic abnormality. If you ask them how long a foot is, you know, they're going to show you something that's different than that, because what they perceive as size is not accurate. So yes, so sometimes people are angry. Sometimes people are in denial. Sometimes people are relieved. So I don't know that I could say there's any – it's always a new day finding out.
And a lot of times, I mean, this irrationality and this irascibility that they can display, I suppose, when they're confronted with this comes from the fact that they're starving. Something is chemically deficient in their brains because they're starving, right?
Yes, and there was Ansel Keys was a researcher at the University of Minnesota in the 40s and 50s, did an experiment called the semi-starvation experiment that, you know, and you can go read about that. But the bottom line is when he took healthy men, young men, and starved them and then refed them, which is sort of akin to the process you might go through if you had anorexia and then you were refed, although, again, with a different psychology. These guys were psychologically normal. They showed all of those same signs that people struggling with anorexia show in terms of the psychology as well as the physiology. So they were anxious, they were depressed, they were irascible, they were angry, they developed weird food things like putting too much salt and ketchup on everything. One guy cut off three of his own fingers out of anxiety. So a lot of the things that have, you know, traditionally been associated with, well, there must be like a psychological abnormality, Keys really showed that some of them definitely come from the sheer condition of being malnourished and then refed.
So even if you have you certainly have a problem when you start exhibiting signs, the worse it gets, the more you starve yourself, the worse it gets.
Well, you know, I wish it was that linear, but I know with our daughter what we observed was, you know, some of the worst emotional and psychological times were actually when she was very close to being at a healthy weight. I don't know why.
I don't either, but I can say that I tell families that, you know, there are bumps in the road and you move on. And we
sometimes mountains.
Sometimes it's – and remember, depending on their medical state, we may not let them exercise at all. And that is really hard for some people. So that there's that anger piece, or we – let them start exercising very small amounts, 15 minutes twice a week, and it may involve an extra snack. And then, you know, where things were going fine. And some of our patients will choose not to exercise because that means that food and that disconnect. So
we have an email from Dennis. Scientists have seen a correlation between brain function in alcoholics and that same function in those with eating disorders. I think a major problem in treating eating disorders as opposed to treating alcoholism would be that one can survive without alcohol, but everyone must eat. I'd like to hear your guests' comments on this.
So this is a simple answer. You have a disease and food is your medicine. That is as simple as I get with some patients when we are at a point of, why are you doing this to me? This kind of thing that that's my answer, and so I guess that's a comment on his comment.
And I think it goes back to what we were saying about cognitive abilities when you're starving, right? And so often in mental health, you know, the way I was trained, especially when it comes to adolescence, is all about developing autonomy, right? And so you want to be able to help this teenager to become empowered to make good decisions. But with anorexia, they're not at a place where they can make good decisions, which is why it's so important that the family is involved. You know, in this this Maudsley method developed, you know, in London in the 1980s and more recently here in the United States the last 10, 15 years is so powerful. It's a very different way for those of us in the psychological world to think about the treatment of an eating disorder.
Okay. You, when you discovered, when you realized that Kitty's problem had progressed to the point where help needed to be sought out, you explored a lot of different options. And I know that you looked at sending her away to a program that cost thousands of dollars a day, and which you visited, I believe, and said it reminded you of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You said that had the diagnosis been diabetes, there would have been a concrete road to recovery, but that is not the case with anorexia. Why not after all these years?
Well, I could probably talk for an hour about that, but I think one issue is that people who treat eating disorders come at this from many different perspectives. There's psychologists, there's pediatricians, there's, you know, nutritionists, and there's not necessarily agreement in the field about causes or treatments. So there's some, you know, differences there. But I think the bottom line is it's a very difficult illness to treat.
And the conventional wisdom in the United States is that you institutionalize people who need this help.
It was. Let me say, if that's the case, if that's the information a family is getting, they need to consider getting another opinion. That certainly is not evidence-based treatment for anorexia in the U.S. now or for the last 10 years.
But when you started this on this road, was it? Was the Maudsley method, this family involvement method,
it was very unusual? It wasn't known very much, and there's been a number of randomized controlled trials done, RCTs done since then. And what we know now through multi-site, multi-year research is that for adolescents, family-based treatment should almost always be the first-line treatment. It doesn't mean it works for everybody, but it is by far and away the most successful treatment modality for most families.
And let me comment on that. So on families where Maudsley or family-based treatment may not be appropriate, then cognitive behavioral therapy is is the next type of treatment. But the old parentectomy, remove the parent, one of the first thing I tell parents when I meet them is, you didn't cause this. It is not because of how you look or those kind of things, because the conventional wisdom when I was in medical school is it's because it's the mom's fault, of course, because everything's the mom's fault. And we're away from that psychoanalytic thought now, I hope, that for families, and ultimately at the beginning, what caused it isn't as important as getting them medically stable and working on getting healthy.
Right, absolutely. And I think that with the family-based treatment, you know, what the research has shown is that it's really, really powerful for younger folks when you can have this kind of family engagement. And it's so important, but it's exhausting. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's not easy. But, you know, if you think about this, if your child had cancer, would you say that you know, chemotherapy was optional? And would you let your child go to their chemo treatments by themselves? Heck no. You would do whatever you had to do to save your child's life. And that's just as, you know, energizes, we have to come around people with anorexia and the prevention of that, because it doesn't have to get to that point.
But you were swimming upstream. This was not the norm when you decided to follow this path. Why did you decide to go against the conventional wisdom?
Conventional wisdom made absolutely no sense to me. I have always been close with my daughter. I knew that she needed to eat. It did not make sense to me. We got advice from a couple therapists saying things like, don't be the food police. You know, so that meant to me, I'm supposed to sit at the table with her and watch her eat two peas for dinner and know that she's starving. You know, I'm not going to do that any more than I'm going to let her bring a fifth of vodka to the breakfast table and just drink it while I say, you know, dear, you really shouldn't drink that. No. You know, I'm going to set some boundaries. And in this case, I know my daughter well. I knew what she needed, and I knew that that was not going to work for her. And she herself did not want to go away, did not want to be sent away. On some level, although I wouldn't say she was compliant at all, because people, you can't really be with this illness, she knew, I think, on some level that she needed to be held closer, not
pushed
that she
away.
Couldn't cope
this
with this
seems
on
like
her own.
Common sense.
It is common sense. Let me say, in some sense, that Dr. Locke and LaGrange, who really are the folks who have really brought Maudsley to the U.S., one of their quotes I love is that it's not rocket science.
No, it's
this,
not.
This is, I tell parents, this is a battle for their child. And yet, I give this advice, and I'm not going home and dealing with it, and I never have had to yet, and I hope I don't. But it is, we are empowering families to do what they have done up until this time, feed their child, and they've been able to do it, and not measure every quarter cup, how many ounces, just feed them.
So what was the experience like? What did you have to do as a parent? What did the family have to do as siblings and mothers and fathers, et cetera, to help Kitty?
We had to make this our top priority because Kitty needed to eat 6 times a day, and she needed one of us, my husband and myself, to eat with her.
To eat with her?
Yes, to eat
with her. Not just to watch her eat?
Not in the beginning, no. Okay. We ate with her. I mean, people do it all different ways, but we actually matched her bite for bite, which wasn't easy because one of the other things that happens when you're malnourished with anorexia is you become hypermetabolic. She was a tiny little thing. She needed 5,000 calories a day to even gain like 0.5 pound a week. So she needed to eat extremely large quantities of food. So we became very good at, figuring out the smallest volume, the most efficient calorie delivery devices, premium ice creams, almond butter slathered on a bagel,
But if you're normal weight and you're eating 6 times a day and you're eating premium ice cream, which is full of butter fat,
mm-hmm.
We
did not gain weight.
You?
Nothing. I think all the anxiety, whatever, but I really didn't care at that point. I would have done anything. And that is, yes, it is a difficult process to go through, but personally, it was much easier for me to sort of mobilize our forces and feel like we could take this on than to simply sit by and watch my daughter diminish and possibly die. I couldn't stand that.
Why is it important that a family sits down and eats bite for bite?
No, well, that was Harriet's family.
Yeah, that's not important.
That was their experience. That's not necessarily, the protocol for every family. And every family is a little different, but it is about the family coming around together and the parents feeding their child, refeeding their child.
And let's say who family is. It can be a sibling. It can be aunts, uncles. We, it's a lot of food involved. I was at a meeting where a parent brought up, I hadn't thought of, when somebody is sick or has a heart attack or has a baby, all your girlfriends make a little spreadsheet and you bring people dinner for 6 or 8 weeks. This is a lot of food. Mobilize your resources. Ask people at your faith-based community, casseroles are great for eating disorder patients. You're bringing, so because it's a lot of food, a lot of cooking, a lot of organization. And for some families, that's a challenge with typical nutritional needs in a family. Add this in and it becomes hard. And then we haven't talked about, so sometimes we have patients who have made certain nutritional restrictions, and it's hard. It takes a lot of lentils and legumes to add up to proteins. If somebody says they're vegan, it's really hard. And it's up to the family and the patient what choices they're going to make. But as their medical provider and as our dietitian will tell, you have a goal to meet, and it's within those choices to do. So it is a lot of food.
So if you're eating 6 times a day and someone in the family is eating with the person, how do you get that person to eat?
Yes, that is the heart of the question, right? And every family solves it differently. And that is what is so great about FBT. Because there is
FBT
no
is
family-based treatment,
okay.
Also known as the Maudsley approach. There's no one way to do this. What it relies on a family's knowledge of their child. And so, for example, for us, when our daughter was hospitalized for 5 days when her heart rate dropped very low, and they wanted to give her a feeding tube, she was afraid of the feeding tube. That is what sort of enabled her to start eating again. And so for the first few weeks she was home, that was what we used as kind of leverage, not as a punishment, but more as, look, if you can't eat, and I understand that, we're going to have to go back to the hospital and get a feeding tube because starving is not an option. Later on, we used other methods, you know, like she really wanted to go to school. This happened in the summer, and she wanted to start school in the fall with all her friends. Okay, you know, we want you to go to school too, but you have to eat all your meals and snacks in order to do that. So it involves your knowledge of your child. They have to trust you on some level. And what I believe you're doing as a parent is standing by your child and saying, I am stronger than that voice in your head.
How long a process was this?
Well, for us, the phase one, there's three phases in FBT. Phase one is the refeeding. For us, it took a year because she grew 4 inches that year because her growth had been suppressed by not eating enough. So it really just depends.
I have a minute. So phase two is?
Phase two is gradually transferring control of eating back to the child. So it's a sort of transitional phase. And then phase three is resuming normal adolescent development.
How old is Kitty today?
Today she's 22.
Wow. How's she doing?
She is still in a process of recovery. You know, she did well all through high school, and then she relapsed.
She's an adult now, so who monitors that? Who makes sure that she's... You do.
We work with her. It is a slightly different process, for sure. She's not 14. We're not sitting her down and telling her what to do, but it is a collaborative process, and she turns to us. She knows she needs our support.
And this is the approach that the Teen Health Connection takes and that the Levine Children's Medicine takes? This family-based approach?
Yes, whenever possible. And that said, it really is family-based approach, and it's changed the outcome of eating disorders.
Dr. Preeti Matkins, MD, Medical Director of Teen Health Connection, Libby Seyfert, psychologist and executive director there, and Harriet Brown, author of Brave Girl Eating, A Family's Struggle with Anorexia. Thanks for the hour.